Service Budget Reform to order. Today is Tuesday, May 6th. We are continuing in our informational format, and you can tell by the throngs gathered in the ultra uncomfortable hard wooden chairs, the many that are willing to endure the and make the sacrifice to come see the august Kevin Earls from the Oregon Hospital.
This
is a high price ticket.
This would be the C ticket.
Although Ellen is off seeing Ozzy Rose. I mean, she told everyone, or Ozzy Osbourne, she told everyone she's going to see her grandchild play baseball. She's off to the Ozzy Osbourne concert. We're delighted to have Kevin with us to talk about OHP reimbursement policies, someone who knows quite a bit about that subject. Kevin, we're happy to have you. Please proceed, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Kevin Earls with the Oregon Association of
Hospitals. You better get real friendly with those microphones.
And I am pleased to be here.
Yeah, pull one of them in today.
Closer.
Right.
There you go.
You got it. Like I said, you got to develop
a heavy breathing, just personal
relationship with those microphones.
Thank you again for the opportunity to be here and to talk with you about our perspective on the effect of the state's Medicaid reimbursement policies on other components of the healthcare delivery system. I will be working from a document today that we have provided to all of you. I have additional copies here if you'd like. And I've also given you a copy of the slides. By way of background, for as long as I've been involved in healthcare and Medicaid funding in Oregon, and for many years before that time, I know there has been a lot of discussion about the adequacy of Medicaid payments. And I am still relatively new with the Hospital Association and have really come in from a private purchaser perspective, having worked with private industry for many years in health policy. And one of the things that I was struck by when I came into this position was the amount of argument that occurs between providers over what I would characterize as a fundamentally inadequate pot of money. And that much of the discussion in Oregon tends to be between provider groups trying to arm wrestle and make their case why they should be paid more money at the expense of others in the provider group. What I've not seen happen is groups of providers working together to increase the overall pot of money that's available for funding Medicaid. And I think that to the degree that that has not happened, we've all lost. So in talking with the Board of Trustees for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems about a year ago, we discussed the idea of commissioning a independent study to really look at the issue of provider costs and provider payments in the Medicaid program. And the board authorized that work, and we went through an RFP process and interviewed a variety of firms and ended up hiring a company called the Lewin Group, which is based in Virginia. Coincidentally, was one of the initial consulting firms that helped the state of Oregon guide its thinking when it put the original Oregon Health Plan together. The Lewin Group is known for doing a lot of healthcare consulting, and a lot of it focuses on Medicaid, and they are actively involved in consulting with many states in this country, with state Medicaid directors, on how to run their programs most effectively. So they understand Medicaid and Medicaid payment from kind of the inside as well as kind of from the outside payer perspective or provider perspective. So with that background, I'm going to walk through what I think are some key points that were that resulted from Lewin's study of Medicaid payments over the past 3 or 4 years in the state of Oregon, and help perhaps draw some conclusions about that effect on really three questions. How adequate is the Oregon health plan payment methodology when you compare it to providers' actual costs of providing care? How does Oregon's payment system compare to Medicaid payments in other states and to Medicare? And third, what effect does Oregon's Medicaid payment policy have on the access of health care in the state? And to that last point, I'm really probably just going to build upon things that have been discussed before this committee by our colleagues from the Oregon Medical Association. But I will talk about access briefly, but both from the Medicaid perspective and also kind of the bigger perspective of how it affects other Oregonians that are not in the Medicaid program but also want to have health insurance. I would say also at the outset that one of the things that we wanted to accomplish in this study was to, in effect, create a benchmark that would say, okay, here's what it costs to provide care, and here's what payments are, and how well do the two match up, and in effect, how are we doing as a state? And I think that's particularly important because the discussions in the development of House Bill 3624 focus on that same kind of concept, that there needs to be a way of measuring the state's performance against the actual cost of providing care. So I hope you'll find it helpful in that regard. So we're going to look at adequacy, comparability, and access. And I'm going to harken back first to kind of key policy goals from the Oregon Health Plan circa 1994. We wanted to reduce the percentage of the uninsured in Oregon. We wanted to improve the quality of health care. We wanted to promote the stability of the healthcare delivery system and to emphasize the use of managed care to help us control costs and expand the availability of coverage with the savings. And we wanted to reduce or eliminate cost shifting to other payers, including employers and individuals, and also to the state, which is state and local governments, which are very large purchasers of healthcare services in the state. So why are, looking first to the adequacy of payments, why are Medicaid payment levels important? And I'd suggest that there are at least kind of four key reasons. One is what I think of as the hydraulic effect. And the way I think of things in the provider world is we have three customers. You know, it's really kind of simple. We have Medicaid, Medicare, and commercial. And that comprises virtually our entire customer base. And in the realm of the two Medicare and Medicaid government-sponsored programs, we're, in effect, price takers. The price is set for us. We have very little ability to influence how we're paid. And as a result, in both of those cases, we are, not surprisingly, paid less than our cost for care, which leaves, when you think about the third purchaser, private commercial insurers, it leaves this hydraulic effect of whatever we lose in caring for Medicare and Medicaid, you know, it has to be made up for in the commercial rates that are charged and what we negotiate with commercial insurers. So that's the hydraulic effect. And when I think about those three customers, if you will, from your perspective, I think, well, you know, commercial insurance is the market, and, you know, we need to set appropriate policies for how carriers operate in the state. And Oregon's done a very good job, and the legislature's been very active in that role. In Medicare, you know, we don't get treated well, but we're 1% of the country. We have limited influence at the federal level, and there's not a lot that the state can do to influence it. But with Medicaid, it's kind of our one opportunity to influence the payment system and the relative level of underpayment and help ease the burden that is shifted over into the commercial payer. So that's, you know, that's really the target, because that's where you can have the most effect. The second is the leverage of federal funds, and I know that, you know, much of this is old hat to you all, but
Can I just interrupt this for a moment? In terms of your sense of the hydraulic effect, does it matter that this third category you have is really a lot more complex than that? I mean, that includes the uninsured. It includes insurance organizations you have a different relationship with than other insurance organizations. I mean, does that really make any difference, or is it for us simply make enough sense to think about it in the three buckets?
Chair Westland, Representative Greenlick, I think that from a policy perspective, it's best to look at it kind of at the 30,000 foot level. I think it's more helpful to look at averages. For instance, what is the average rate of percent of cost that commercial carriers must pay for hospital services? You know, it's going to be, it obviously has to be above 100% of cost in order to make up for Medicare and Medicaid. And, you know, if you hold Medicare constant because you can't really influence it, then there's pretty much a direct relationship between how low you go on Medicaid and how fortunately high you have to go on Medicare. So I'd look at it at the higher level. Thank you. So the leveraging of federal funds is important because I think, you know, in any environment, it's important, but in our current economy, you know, it's really the best and one of the only opportunities for the state to, in effect, leverage outside money in a struggling economy. So, you know, we don't have an opportunity in most other state programs to draw down a federal match, and certainly not at the kind of levels that we're seeing in the Medicaid program. The third reason why I think Medicaid payment levels are critical is provider participation. And I think of this both really in terms of physicians, and the OMA, I think, does an excellent job of helping present the struggle that physicians face in trying to determine how much they can afford to participate in Medicaid when they're paid very poorly relative to keeping their practices afloat. But it's also true when you think about provider participation to think about commercial health plans and the fact that, you know, in Oregon we've seen virtually every commercial insurer leave the market as a result of poor reimbursement rates because they have felt that they cannot cross-subsidize their participation in a Medicaid program, so they need to, in effect, stay out. And, you know, certainly Kaiser's departure after 35 years of being involved in Medicaid in this state is, I think, kind of the canary in the coal mine. Finally, the impact on the state's economy, and, you know, just to kind of double back on the leveraging of federal funds, as we cut a dollar from Medicaid, we lose $2.50 from the state economy. And one of the things that I think is so powerful about Medicaid from a economic development point of view is that it is naturally distributive in the economy. You know, it's when you put Medicaid money to work in the Oregon economy, it doesn't land in Washington County. It goes into every community and every small town in throughout the state. So from an economic development or buoyancy point of view, it's very effective at lifting all boats throughout the state. And I think that's really important. And I didn't mean to besmirch Washington County. I just meant that it's not focused on one part of the state.
It's okay to do.
It's noted.
So adequacy of payments. The Oregon Health Plan principle was always to reimburse providers at rates that cover the cost of care. That is the concept that is built into the managed care rate setting process. But we know from the discussion of our fully capitated health plan partners that it ain't happening. You know, they have the ability to kind of move money around in the capitated payment rate they receive, but they are very clear that they feel that the amount of money that is allocated to various provider buckets in their capitated payment rate is not adequate or accurate. And there is a lack of transparency there that I think is important for policymakers to address. And then the second bullet, the need to distinguish between managed care rates and fee-for-service rates, is really kind of a note for, as we go through some of the slides, I think that it has always been the intention of the state of Oregon to pay providers at rates that allow them to cover their costs or near that. I think that there was always an intention to pay close to the same rates, whether it's in a fee-for-service or managed care system, knowing that managed care could create savings as a result of the management actions that wouldn't accrue to fee-for-service providers. But what we've seen is that throughout the 8 or so years that the health plan's been in place, we've had a managed care rate setting process that gets recalibrated every year, but the fee-for-service rate has been relatively flat. And so it has begun to punish those communities and those providers that are practicing in a fee-for-service rates structure. So if you're in a community that doesn't have managed care, providers are paid these very low fee-for-service rates, you know, it makes it increasingly difficult for them to participate. And it creates a bigger cost shift in those regions of the state. So I'm going to turn next to...
I can't read that either.
This is going to be difficult.
Can you get the lights in the back?
Can't read it on the paper?
We got Kelly on the job.
Well, we're going to see four slides that use the same format. So let me walk you through the format. As you may be aware, Oregon pays, and I'm focusing on hospitals here for a while, it pays two different ways to two different kinds of hospitals. We have urban and large rural hospitals. Let's see if this works.
Where am I seeing that?
Okay. See that?
All right.
Urban and large rural hospitals, and then small rural hospitals, which are type A and B hospitals with less than 50 beds. And they're paid on a different basis. Small rural hospitals are paid on 100% of cost basis, and urban and large rural hospitals are paid on a DRG basis. And what this chart shows is how Medicaid allowable costs compare to Medicaid payments for those two groups of hospitals, again, urban and large rural and small rural. And so you're going to look at the allowable costs, the payments in that column, and the relative difference. And then this final column is what I think is probably most important in going back to this 30,000-foot level perspective that I think is important. What is the payment-to-cost ratio? How do payments and costs compare? What is the ratio of those two? And what this slide is showing is that, in effect, in 1999, the payment-to-cost percentage for urban and large rural hospitals for inpatient was 76%. Right there. And it was 83% for outpatient for a combined total, a weighted total of 78%. On the small rural hospital, they were paid generally 100% of cost on the outpatient side, and they were receiving 78% of their cost on the inpatient side for a weighted average of 86%. So when you threw all of those totals into a bucket, hospitals on a statewide basis were paid 79% of their costs. This is in the managed care side. Now we're going to look at how that changed in 2001. And I should tell you that in preparing the 99 chart, Lewin used the most recent finalized Medicaid cost reports that are submitted to the state after they'd been audited. So all the cost reports had gone through an audit process. And then in 2001, they updated the information based on doing a combination of interviews with providers a series of reports that are available from OMAP to, in effect, update those payment-to-cost ratios.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
Yeah. Kevin, since A's and B's are supposed to be true cost reimbursement, why aren't they?
It's a good question. In many cases throughout the state, whether it's an A or B hospital or a DRG hospital, hospitals may be part of a managed care delivery system, or rather the managed care
system may be a contract.
So they may contract.
Okay.
It's what the two parties have agreed to do.
Okay.
And I think that that's important because it shows that even though they're formally entitled to 100% of cost, they're often contracting for less.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Miller.
Well, never seen you look better. Self-service gasoline, if I may.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, about
20
miles south.
Kevin, how did that outpatient number here? I mean, I'm really intrigued with the outpatient going now from 83 to 72. How did outpatient expenses jump so much in 2 years? From $59 million or something to $87
million. Well, part of that can be utilization, but
it's a huge amount.
Look at the unit price.
Take some moment.
That'll give you a better indication, isn't it?
Something's wrong.
No.
Did it really happen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller. The
I also want to talk about speed limits.
You're going too fast for me. The a significant part of what happened is a result of migration from site of service from inpatient to outpatient. We're seeing much more migration to an outpatient setting. So that was part of what happened.
Huge.
Yeah. So really you're looking at a decline in the payment rates from about 78% on the urban and large rural side to 74, and a fairly constant percentage on small rural at 86, but you had a 3% decline overall. But remember I said that, you know, part of the focus needs to be on what's happening in fee-for-service, because we're seeing a huge decline in the amount of covered lives in the Medicaid program. In managed care, we were at, you know, in the, I think, 85% at probably the high water mark, and we're down to about 61% now. So we're seeing much more migration into the fee-for-service setting.
Mr. Chair, if we go back to that, those numbers still, in the large hospitals, the total cost went up roughly 30% in those 2 years, the combined inpatient and outpatient, right? You go back one?
224 to 289.
Forward one.
I mean, it
224
went
to 289.
289, that's about a 30% increase in the total Medicaid allowable cost of hospitalization and outpatient from nine in 2 years. That it just seems like a lot.
I'm sorry,
that,
give it to me
that
again.
289 number right there.
The total Medicaid allowable cost for DRG hospitals?
Right. It was
224.
So it went up about 30%, the total cost.
Yeah.
This did, huh?
It did.
15% a year.
That I think that sounds right.
And the reimbursements went up from 174 to 214.
That's just it.
Probably like 40. It went up 20%.
And I think that hospitals receive a fairly significant bump in their component of the managed care rate in during that time period. But I you know, I can't break it down further for you at this point. So now I'm going to look at fee-for-service payment-to-cost ratios. And again, we're looking at, on the fee-for-service side in 99, small rural hospitals were getting 100% of their cost on fee-for-service. But on the DRG side, urban and large rural, they're being paid 74% on inpatient, 74% of their costs, 59% of their costs on outpatient, for a combined total of 71%, bringing the statewide average down to 76%. In 2001...
Just a comment, if I may.
Oh,
that means the costs on the fee-for-service side went up 60% in that time period, in a two-year time period, or went up 60 million. 60%, that's also 60% increase in fee-for-service costs over 2 years under Medicaid. That's just very odd.
For the DRG.
Yeah, went up from that 94 million.
You're looking at, but when the number that you're looking at is, you know, I mean, it's utilization driven. I mean, we're not talking about an increase in the rate. We're talking about an increase in the amount of expenditures.
That's a 60% increase in expenditures for the Medicaid fee-for-service hospital costs in a two-year period. It just seems amazing.
It is a dramatic increase in utilization, but, you know, I would just qualify it by saying, you know, when you're a hospital and you're being paid 71% of your cost on every unit of service, you're working hard to try and limit utilization and limit length of stay in order to manage your losses. This fourth slide is Medicaid fee-for-service payments to cost ratios for 2001. We've seen a further decline to 3% overall statewide, 69% for the DRGs on a combined basis. We're down to 72% for inpatient and 59% for outpatient. So let me back up and show that in 2001, the difference between, on the managed care side, the difference between the cost of providing care and the payments was $80 million on the managed care side. And on the fee-for-service side, it was $48 million. So that gives you some perspective as to how much hospitals are losing in their payment for Medicaid service.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
Kevin. Is the Medicaid allowable what you consider to be are they pretty close to your true costs?
It's close, but it's lower.
Yeah, so not even, it's close then, but it's not the actual true cost.
No, because Medicare and consequently Medicaid eliminate some costs under the concept of allowable. So they're costs that the hospital incurs, but they're not allowed to be considered in the reimbursement base.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Bates.
How what would you put that at 90% of cost, 95%? I mean, you said it's close, but what's close?
I
have no idea.
I have no idea. I'm guessing it's probably, it's single digits, probably 2%. You mean the difference between actual, you know, total cost and allowable costs, and it's going to vary from facility to facility.
So it's in the ballpark, but low.
Yes.
Okay. Well, last question. What's really intriguing here is I know healthcare costs have gone up, especially in the hospital setting, and there's lots of reasons for that.
Oh, hurry up, Kevin.
I got 10 seconds or less, man. The billing goes. When the chair wants fresh cookies, he wants fresh cookies. And in the time you're looking at 990 to 01, you're looking at a 20-30% increase in hospital costs, which I think are real. And I think there's a lot of things driving that, and that's Med-Mal, increased cost for personnel, some federal regulations. Do you have any idea what drove those costs so high for hospitals? And plus utilization.
Again, I think the point I'm trying to make is that these are when it says Medicaid allowable costs, those are what the payments were. So it means, in effect, a big part of it's got to be utilization. But, you know, from our perspective, you're still looking at being paid, 72 cents on the dollar for fee-for-service inpatient based on, on the standard that the feds set. You've got, utilization, technology, aging. I mean, those are the factors that are driving up hospital costs.
Not aging in this population.
Well, and there are costs and there are costs, and we can get into slicing that so many different ways. I think the important thing of what Kevin's trying to show is A, the increased cost, and B, the gap between, you can knock that off a couple percentage. You can, how much is going in for remodeling and how much is the expensive wallpaper versus the,
I'm not worried about
the Target wallpaper.
Mr. Jett's exactly the point I'm trying to make, that these costs are legitimate. These increased costs are legitimate. And what we're trying to show is the gap there. And I was trying to help you flesh
Mr.
that
Chair
out.
Chair Representative Bates, I appreciate your attempt to help me in that regard.
Okay.
So just some conclusions to draw from those four charts. Obviously, Oregon is not paying at rates that allow providers to cover their costs of care, certainly not when we look at hospitals. It's resulting in a corresponding shift by providers to other purchasers, again, individuals, businesses, state and local governments. In 1999, the cost of the hospital portion of underpayment was $81 million. It's gone to $130 million as of 2 years ago. And we know that trend has continued, most recently as a result of a series of payment and policy changes that were implemented by OMAP in March of this year, in which they cut hospital reimbursement for the urban and large rural hospitals by 12% more on inpatient and outpatient, and they eliminated coverage for Medicaid outlier for virtually the entire Medicaid outlier program, and they redefined eligibility so as to eliminate so-called retroactive eligibility, which is a very significant factor for hospitals, about $45 million a year. So how does Oregon's Medicaid payment system, we're not meeting a standard that we set for ourselves in 1993 when we passed the legislation. How do we compare with other states and with Medicare? And then I added a section on how do hospital use rates, capacity, and length of stay compare with other states, because I think it's important. In some states, you might say that they're paying low because hospitals are inefficient, and that might be in some measure equitable. But in Oregon, as you'll see, hospitals are leading the nation in terms of efficiency on these metrics. And so that's obviously not why payments are low. So first, payment comparability comparing to other state Medicaid spending. Oregon ranks 39th lowest in spending. Now, this is 2000 data, 2000 CMS data, spending per enrollee, which puts us behind North Carolina, Alabama, Missouri, Texas, and West Virginia. Yes.
Rick. Thank you, Chair. Just a quick question, Kevin. Can you break out the acute somatic health care from long-term care in this when you talk about Medicaid spending? It's not a mix of both long-term care and acute health care.
It is what is recorded to HCFA on their 2082 and 64 reports. And to be candid, I don't know the answer to that question. All I know is that it's held. It's the same. It's it's the same for all states.
Across, yeah.
They don't include administrative costs, accounting adjustments. They do. They do not include disproportionate share payments. And the way HCFA measures that is they include any person who's eligible for Medicaid at any time during the year. So they count anybody that's signed up during the course of the year. But again, they do that for every state, so it's held constant. So if you look, I don't know if you have copies of this report available to you, but there is an exhibit that I knew wouldn't fit on a slide because it lists every state in the District of Columbia. But in effect, Oregon is spending in 2000 $3,764 per enrollee, about 15% less than the national average. Our counterpart to the north was ranked 23rd. They spent about $558 more per enrollee than Oregon.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mona Sanders.
When we're talking about costs, the $3,764 per Medicaid enrollee, and other states, you say that they pay higher. Are you comparing the actual cost that it takes? For instance, isn't it maybe more expensive in other states? I mean, are we really comparing apples to apples? It could be that we are more efficient or effective, or we can do the same type of job for less. I was just wondering if you know, like doctors are paid more on the East Coast than here in Oregon. Those kinds of comparisons. I mean, when I see that, I see Missouri, Texas, Virginia, Alabama. I understand that, but that they're worse off than we are, according to people. Do you see where I'm going with this? I mean,
I do, and you're right. It doesn't adjust for cost of living. What it does is it looks at the number of Medicaid enrollees and the Medicaid expenditures, and it calculates a raw Medicaid spending per beneficiary. And, you know, certainly some of the difference may be explained by those kinds of factors, but probably not of the magnitude that we're seeing. And again, I'm not talking about comparing Oregon to any of the top states. I'm just talking about to the average.
How do we compare with Washington, state of Washington?
We're about 13 points lower on scale. They spend about $558 more per enrollee than we have.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, $200 per month more. That's pretty significant money. I think the point that Mr. Bacovian was trying to get at, and this is critical that we all understand this, and if you could try and look into this a little bit, Kevin. You know, if we're trying to compare apples to apples and have, you know, look at acute care, you know, versus long-term care, then this is an assumption on my part, but I would. You know, that's a relative scale based on how much other states spend in relation to what Oregon spends on long-term care. And we have, and continue, fortunately, to have one of the best long-term care systems in the country. And I would venture to guess we spend more than other states on that long-term care, and therefore that 39th lowest could actually be even lower if that number, all those numbers include long-term care.
Mr. Chairman, I'll find out, and you make a good point.
Mr. Chair,
I'll find the answer to that question.
Do we rank about there with Medicare spending as well?
I think I might have Medicare spending, and I can answer the question, but I can't do it from the top of my head.
It's really a lot lower.
We're very low in Medicare spending per beneficiary. but not as low as Medicaid. So, and on to another slide that you can't read.
Even more.
Mr. Chair.
This is Representative Bates.
Kevin, I think you know this. Let's make it clear, though. In Medicare, we don't have a lot of control.
Right.
Medicaid, we have complete control.
Very important point, right?
We've made the decision to not reimburse people at a reasonable rate in this state.
On what?
We have made a decision not to reimburse providers at a reasonable rate in this state. That is what we've decided to do.
That's Medicaid,
your point.
Not Medicaid.
And Medicaid. In Medicare, we haven't got a lot of control, but in Medicaid, it's a state decision for the most part. Correct?
Correct.
But Medicare is not an issue of control. It's an issue of our utilization patterns because the expenditure estimates are the same, and it's just that we use less care per enrollee in Medicare than other states use.
Mr. Chair, I would argue that point.
I don't know about that.
It's the chicken and the egg kind of stuff, okay? Medicare is determined on the history of what you've done, and they've written the history for us. They started at a rate that was too low to start with,
at a rate that was too low to start with
25 years ago or whatever, and has continued to raise that at the same percentage for the most part across the country, producing a situation in which our Medicare rates are progressively getting worse. Or not gaining enough fast enough, from my point of view.
You're talking about the managed care component of the AAPC, but that's based on the fee-for-service utilization. Our fee-for-service rates per capita in Medicare have always, from the beginning, been 25 to 30% lower than the nation as an average.
And I would argue that was inappropriate at that time and remains so. I've talked to people who set that study up from Dartmouth, and I've argued with them, and I think they were wrong.
And we can...
That's a whole different program.
Out in the parking lot.
Chair Westland, Representative Greenlick, the one contribution I'd make on that point is that in the last administration, the state, I believe, actually joined a suit with the state of Minnesota over the disparity of Medicare payment rates and how Oregon was being disadvantaged under the federal system by how they were being reimbursed on Medicare.
On risk Medicare, on the AAPCC. But the fact is, for better or for worse, historically, in the fee-for-service side of Medicare, we have used hospital rates, for example, as you know, 20 to 25% less than the average through our own behavior, not because the federal government told us to do that. That translates into lower AAPCCs under managed care, but basically we have a different pattern.
A perfect segue to the next slide that you can't see. To hospital utilization rates, 2001, and this really goes to, I think, a measure of efficiency, a way of looking at how hospitals are operating in this state relative to their peers in other states. This chart shows a Oregon number compared to the U.S. average and the difference. The top row is beds per 1,000 population. Oregon's at 1.78. The U.S. average is 2.64, a difference of about 33%. Inpatient days per 1,000, Oregon's at 382. The U.S. average is about 600, a 36% difference.
Yeah, that was exactly my point.
Yeah. Average length of stay, a little under 4 days. The U.S. average is over 5. So a 22% difference. Occupancy rate is lower, and admissions per 1,000 in the population is about 18% lower. So on the basis of these metrics, you can see that both practice patterns and, as Representative Greenlick says, kind of our natural tendency has us using hospitals for shorter periods of time, less frequently, and that we have a capacity level that is much leaner than our peers nationally. The final point is the issue of access to care, and I think this is, while Representative Bates makes the point that we have made a decision as a state to not pay providers adequately in the Medicaid program, I think he really means that we have backed into that. We haven't made a very conscious decision, perhaps. We understand, you know, kind of intellectually, that it makes no sense to underpay providers when 60% of the cost is being picked up by the federal government. As I like to say, you know, any employer in the state would love to have a 60% subsidy for their insurance program for their employees. The state has offered that, and yet they leverage providers by underpaying them. And it affects all kinds of players in the system. Medicaid enrollees are impacted because they have a significantly reduced level of physician participation in the program.
Yeah.
And because physicians are not required to participate in Medicaid, you know, they have to make individual decisions about whether they can afford to stay in Medicaid, how much Medicaid business that they can juggle and still maintain a margin to keep their doors open. We've had a direct connection with commercial health plan participation, and we've seen virtually every commercial health plan in the state drop out of participation in the Oregon Health Plan because of the poor rates. Communities are impacted. At the community hospital level, there are a number of community hospitals that are threatened by the current low payment rates that are in place in Oregon. They're predominantly smaller rural facilities where closure would mean a tremendous lack of medical attention at the local level. It also means that there will be a loss of individual hospital programs in local communities, and those are the programs that may have a disproportionately high enrollment of Medicaid participants in it. And when a hospital is faced with a 12% reimbursement cut on top of a poor reimbursement base to begin with, as they are now based on the March actions by OMAP, they have to look at those ancillary programs and say, where am I losing money? What do I have to cut in order to be able to keep my doors open? And the programs that they're going to cut are the ones that are disproportionately utilized by Medicaid recipients. And I think finally the thing that's, you know, most overlooked when we look at Medicaid reimbursement rates is what is the impact that it's having on commercial rates in the rest of the state. I mean, it's not like when the state underpays, those costs go away or the people just quit using health care. It's just a hidden tax that's directly shifted onto the backs of the commercial payer, and it's done so without the benefit of the federal match. So it's just not prudent. There's no policy justification for paying at those rates. The final slide I have, I wanted to show one of the findings of the Lewin study relative to physician payment conversion factors. And you have five different conversion factors listed, starting with Oregon Medicaid fee-for-service at $26. And I think that the original conversion factor when the health plan started was between $23 and $24. So it hasn't changed much.
It's the RPU multiplier.
It is. The in the Medicaid managed care side, the conversion factors are ranging between $30 and $34. Medicare fee-for-service is at 36, managed Medicare at 40 to 42, and commercial payers at $52 to $58. So it's showing, you know, kind of the disparity between what the state is paying and why they can't get adequate physician participation, which, of course, you know, drives utilization in the emergency room. It keeps people out of less costly earlier care and so forth. But I think this kind of puts a point on one element of reimbursement policy that the state has either backed into or outright chosen to undertake.
And what that slide leaves out of the equation is the uninsured.
That's correct.
Yeah. Representative Berkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I missed what we're measuring in that conversion factor. Conversion from what to what?
Well, physicians are paid on the basis of a relative value unit. So they're paid a base rate times a factor that purports to measure the complexity of the service that they're providing. So things that are more complex, they're paid a higher, they're paid using the fee-for-service rate, $26 times some other number. The more complex, the other number gets higher. So it's a way of...
I'm sorry, what's that?
A return office visit is in most, something like one unit. So you multiply one unit by that, and that would be a return office visit. A physical examination might be 3. And perhaps the RV surgery might be 50 RVUs.
Two things, I guess, that I'd like to close with. One is, you know, as you work on 3624, I think this idea of having a standard by which the state measures its own performance on a biennial basis is really important, so that we get away from how we divide a fundamentally inadequate pie among provider groups and how we force them or ratchet their payments down to comparing, you know, how are we really doing on an equitable level compared to providers' costs. And I think the other thing that is really important is that perhaps unintentionally the disparity between fee-for-service rates and what is built into a managed care rate has grown dramatically over time throughout the history of the Oregon Health Plan. And as a result, providers are paid theoretically on a level that allows them to cover their costs in a managed care rate, but the fee-for-service rates are 20, 30, or higher percentage points lower. So anybody that doesn't have the ability to participate in a fee-for-service or in a managed care structure is, you know, automatically having negative effects as a result of provider participation. And it creates negative unintended incentives for fully capitated health plans. If, as we've seen, if in the absence of a contract between a hospital and a fully capitated plan, the capitated plan only has to pay the fee-for-service rate, which is the policy that the state has now, then what incentive does a fully capitated plan have to pay something that's closer to what is in the cap rate? So I would argue that one of the things that you'd like to help accomplish is a tethering of or a linkage between what is paid in a fee-for-service basis and what is paid in a managed care rate. Because, in effect, you want to incent providers to form managed care arrangements and provide the management and create savings and so forth that result from managed care. But you don't want to punish those areas of the state and those providers that don't have the ability to function in that kind of an arrangement.
Questions?
Everyone in the audience can wake up now.
both of them?
I thought it was impressive that Kevin stayed awake.
I think this is, you know, is very important information. Helps underscore the hydraulic effect that we all discussed so early in the session with Bob DePriet and Goldberg and Rocky King and Barney Spate. We've got some problems, and I think Kevin, you know, helped shine a light on them and again refresh us. We've seen some of this information before. This isn't brand new. I mean, there's always ways to, you know, to slice or dissect what any of the presenters want to say, but overall I think you've summed up very well, you know, put it in a nutshell, pretty much where Oregon is. We appreciate it. I'm happy to say you have not fallen below the standard that was established by the gentleman from First Health when he came to testify here. So we still have, without question, a clear winner in the last in the race of quality testifiers. I mean, you are ahead of that one individual.
Well,
anyway.
And I'll sleep better tonight knowing that.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, ease your conscience. I knew you were going to be concerned about that.
Thank you.
For the committee's benefit, we will not meet tomorrow.
And then I think by Thursday we will have the draft one amendments for the bill. So I'd encourage all of us to be here on time, because we'll have a lot of cussing and discussing to do. Bill remains the same in spirit. Move as many people as we possibly can into managed care, with some exceptions. What's a process by which PCOs can be implemented? Still wrestling with drug purchasing, but we'll roll that all out on Thursday and have a good, frank, robust discussion of the bill. And I think we'll have it pretty good by then. Still some I's to dot, T's to cross. Are you sure you don't have any questions for Kevin? I mean, he just feels, seems so lonely out there. Any other business come before the committee? Perfect timing, Kevin. We've got floor at 4:30, so we're right on target. Yeah, extra points,
And a cookie.
Yeah. And all of us in attendance should thank Jeff Hetherington for the cookies, since he baked them himself.
Hey, is Jeff here?
Yeah, he's right over there.
No walnuts in it, Jeff. I asked for walnuts.
Yeah, I think there's a diuretic and a laxative and a few other things.
Hazelnuts.
Well, before this gets too far out of hand, we are adjourned.